I'll give you the short version. CBS has just declared war on the heartland of America. What this hire means is a redefinition of what is funny and a redefinition of what is comedy. And they're blowing up the 11:30 format under the guise that the world's changing. And people don't want the kind of comedy that Carson gave us or even Letterman. They don't want that anymore. They've hired a partisan so-called comedian to run a comedy show. So that's what I think. Cool.
Oh, my goodness. Rush Limbaugh. As always, Mr. OxyContin himself, telling everybody else how to live their lives when he ain't doing such a swell job of it himself. Anyway, thank you for tuning in. It is the Rebecca Giroux Show, and we got a good one tonight. We've been talking about RuPaul. We've been talking about Drag Race. We've been talking about the anti-transgender slurs that this guy has been spewing for years. And finally... he's getting called out on it. We're getting people like the folks at GLAAD, who we had on the show last week, lining up. Trans people, LGBT, gays, lesbians, bisexual folks, all coming together to say, you know what, this is a problem. This is wrong. We don't need this in our media. We don't need media that hurts our own community. We don't care how much money you're making on it. So we've been talking about that, and we have with us tonight, coming up at the bottom of the hour, Parker Marie Molloy, who, as you may know, is the trans issues columnist for The Advocate. She wrote an article a while back about Jared Leto and the Dallas Buyers Club, and in it, she said a couple of things that got people a little hot under the collar. There was a couple of articles, one by Calpurnia Adams, of course, who you may know, well-known trans woman. I'm gendering carefully because this is a woman who will attack you if you misgender her in any way. Well, I will say trans woman. I hope that's acceptable to her. She's also the woman who was a... of course, preoperative at this time, showgirl who was dating a soldier in the military. His name was Barry Winchell. Barry Winchell was murdered because he was dating Calpurnia Adams. And I will tell you, they're speaking to somebody who was around at that time. I was making media at that time. Well, I was barely making media at that time. I mean, certainly not what I'm doing today. I wasn't doing a radio show. It was the very beginnings of my media work, and I and several others, many other trans women at the time, spoke out against the misgendering of Calpurnia Adams by straight and, let's be honest, gay and lesbian media. Okay? And we spoke out against that, but apparently, well, Calpurnia is... made some charges, pretty serious charges, pretty significant charges. We're going to get into that with Parker. And then Andrea James, who, as you may know, is a well-known filmmaker. She teamed up with Calpurnia many years ago to form a company called Deep Stealth Productions, created something that was very useful to a lot of trans women at the time called Finding Your Female Voice. Both women, significant figures in our community, speaking out, basically accusing Parker of a lot of things that, well, I'll save what I think for later. I'll get into my personal opinions later on in the show. But we're going to take on those issues tonight. Also, I'll let you know, in case you haven't seen it already, I have an op-ed on this topic, which is on the front page of The Advocate today. Getting a lot of attention. Thank you very much to everybody who has... given it that intention. Good discussion going on, but a discussion where, well, you get to see both sides in full bloom. That's a good thing. Because, yeah, you're going to get the folks who are going to say, you know, I have a problem with this, leave RuPaul alone, blah, blah, blah. But you're also, what you saw was, those folks were the first ones to comment on this article, because of course I was watching today to see what the comments were going to be on this piece. And of course the folks who were against me, against my argument, came out and were all over the place. But then the trans folks came in and started commenting. And it has become a real discussion. And you know what? I have seen at least a couple of people who have acknowledged that maybe they're on the wrong side of this argument. And that's what it's all about, folks. Winning them over. That's how we win this. That's how we win stuff like this. You win the folks over that make them say, I never thought of it that way. Yeah, that's how progress is made. So we're going to be getting into all of that. But, you know, I wanted to start tonight. I wanted to start tonight with, well, something, I don't know if this is self-serving or, you know, whatever. But I started writing a book just this week. I've been thinking about this for a while. I mean, I've been batting this idea around for years and say, you know, I really should write a book. I've had people say to me, I've had people who are actually professionals in this business say, you know, Becky, you should write a book because you've got more than enough material for this. And there were times when I tried to collect like a lot of the stuff that I've written over the years and say, well, maybe I can put this all together in a book somehow, add a narrative, da da da. And well, you know, I decided this week I was just going to throw all that out the window. That all those plans that I had made before, I just said the heck with it. And you know what I did? I sat down, I put up my word processing program, and I started writing. I just started saying, you know what? I want to tell my story. As if I was sitting across from somebody across from me. Kind of like the way I do this show. Like, as if you're sitting across the room from me and I'm having a conversation with you. That's the way I like to do this show. You notice I don't stand on a lot of ceremony. We don't do a lot of departments here. We don't do a lot of segments, although we do occasionally, we'll throw in something here and there. But I try to talk to you the way I would talk to you if you were sitting across the table from me, if we were having dinner together, or if I met you in a club somewhere. You know, it's just that's my style. That's just how I do these things. And so I don't know. I find that when I approached it from that angle, when I said, you know what, I'm just gonna start writing. I'm just gonna start writing and I'll see where this goes. And you know what? It worked. I had no problem. I was knocking this stuff out. I mean, page after page after page just came out of me. And I just started putting it down and putting it down. And yeah, you know what? The thing is like, this is like building a house. First, you put up the frame, you put up the framework so you know where you're going and where you have to go. And so you put down the foundation, you put up the framework, and then you fill it in. And so that's what I'm doing now. I'm working on the framework right now. I'm writing the story. Then I'm going to go back and color it in and, you know, add the doors and windows and the bells and whistles and all that stuff that makes it, you know, a real book. I'm not anywhere near there. But even with that, even with just putting the story, putting the essential elements on the page, before I go back and do that kind of thing, which is going to be a while, because, I mean, I've been working on this for about a week. I've got 2.5 chapters done of the basic framework. This is hard work. I mean, people think, you know, writing, oh, how hard can it be? You sit on your ass and you type. I mean, no, this is hard. This is real work. I mean, if you're going to write something and it's going to be any good, I would tell this to any writer, no matter if they were writing a news article or a book or an op-ed or anything, that you have to write from your heart and you have to write from your passion and you have to write from your personal truth or it's going to suck. And that's just reality. Every time I sit down to write an op-ed or I sit down to write something, anything, that I want put out there for public consumption, I write from my heart. You know, now, of course, there's a different way. If I'm writing a feature article, well, that's not the same thing. That's not the place for an opinion, so I don't put that in there. But there is a place for perspective. And, you know, depending on the situation, depending on the topic, depending on which particular media I happen to be presenting that topic in, there's different ways of doing it. What I do on this show is not the same thing that I do when I write an op-ed for The Advocate or for the Huffington Post and the Blerico Project. It's a different kind of media, so it requires a different kind of media creating. It's a different style of product, if you will. And so what I try to do is I try to speak to whoever my audience is or whoever I know my audience is. And it's, and you know, sometimes it's tough because the truth is I can go and I can tell you how many people downloaded the podcast of last week's show, but I can't tell you anything about who they are. I can tell you where most of them live in terms of geography, in terms of what state or what country they're downloading. But I can't tell you anything about those people. I can't tell you how old they are, whether they're trans, whether they're gay, whether they're straight, whether they're black, white, Latino. I can't tell you any of that stuff because, let's be honest, I mean, when you hear about, like for example, everybody is familiar with television ratings, the Nielsen ratings. Everybody's familiar with that. Well, in radio, they have something very, very similar, which is called the Arbitron ratings. And so when a commercial radio station has content, has hosts on the air, has shows and stuff, they can track by using Arbitron and paying, it's a subscription service, you subscribe to them, and they give you the information on who's listening, what the age groups are, which hosts on your network are most popular, which are getting the most listenership, which are losing listenership, what they like. Lots and lots of information that commercial media can get through these kind of rating systems that's not available to me because I'm not a commercial broadcaster. We do this on our own. This is all home-baked. So I have to guess in a lot of cases. I have to rely on you guys. I have to rely on you guys to get in touch with me, to contact me on Facebook, to write to me, to call into this show. Please, for God's sakes, come on, guys. You know, I have to rely on you to tell me who's listening and what you care about and what you think about and what you want from me. What topics do you want me to cover? Is there something I'm not covering that you would like to see covered? I can't tell those things unless you tell me. So, I'm trying to think. I kind of like went off track here, but the reality is when you're a trans media maker, when you're doing what I do and you decide, okay, I'm going to go into a new medium now. I'm going to become, instead of the radio host voice or my op-ed voice, I'm going to take on now a different, new voice, an author voice, a narrative voice, a storyteller voice. Now, of course, I tell stories on this show all the time. And that's one form of storytelling, but this is different. This is long form. This is, you know, we're talking multi-hundreds of pages here. I think I've got about 20 done so far. I mean, seriously, okay? So I'll tell you, it is really... For me, and I know there are a lot of folks in our community who have written books, excellent books, as a matter of fact, and maybe they get this, but, you know, there was one point last week when I was writing, and I was writing a particularly difficult chapter, and I'm not going to tell you what it's about, because I made myself a promise at the beginning of this that I would talk about the process of writing on the show and publicly. But I'm not going to talk about the content. All I will say about the content is This is my story. Just like we've had people like Janet Mock and Jennifer Finney Boylan and other trans authors tell their stories, that's what I'm doing here. I'm telling my story. Beyond that, well, you know, I hope you'll buy the book. because, you know, I'm not going to, I don't want to give it away. Because first of all, because I'm not done with it yet. In any, even the slightest sense. So what I have on done now may be very changed or switched around or altered. I mean, I don't know. I don't know where that's going. So I'm not going to go and get into what I'm actually writing. But I will say it was a very difficult chapter to write. And it was stressful. It was, you know, you get to a point where, I mean, there were points when I found myself wiping tears out of my eyes because I was going back through feelings and memories that I kind of put aside, the stuff I had survived and just had dealt with and had come to terms with many years ago. And sometimes even maybe recently. And now I'm digging back through and I'm recalling where I was at that time, not just physically, but emotionally, intellectually, you know? And so that is not easy. Putting myself back in that place is hard. It is hard work. It is real work. I have to say, it's probably the most, and already is the most difficult media work I have ever done. It really is. And I dig deep. I mean, anyway, if you read my article on The Advocate today, you'll see what it looks like when I dig deep. Okay? That was a tough article to write. That was a tough op-ed to write because I had to go back to a moment in my life that was... It was very emotionally draining, impactful. I won't say more about that. I encourage you to go read it if you haven't already. But it was hard to write that article. But I felt it needed to be said. I felt this was a perspective that needed to be heard, and it needed to be heard as widely as possible. So I was fortunate and grateful that The Advocate accepted it for publication, and it just came out this morning. So, you know, I gained, not that I didn't have it already, but I have gained a new level of respect for people like Janet Mock and Jennifer Finney Boylan and everyone else who says, you know what, it's time for these stories to be told. And you know what? It is. It's time for these stories to be told. And if I truly believe that, and if I think I'm a decent writer, and I do, I think I'm a pretty good writer, as a matter of fact, without sounding like a jerk, but yeah, I think I can write pretty well. I think I've taught myself how to do this. And it's still hard. Even knowing how to write, you still have to dig, and you still have to be able to take those feelings and thoughts and memories and hopes and dreams and put them into print for everybody else to not only read, but understand. And that's hard. So, like I said, new respect for anybody who tries this, because damn, this is hard. Anyway, it looks like, what do you know, Mr. Mike? And look, there's my usual pre-break message from Mr. Mike telling me that we have got Sydney Bullens in Love Letter from Vegas. We will be back after the break with Parker Malloy. Stick around.
I'm the voice of spring. I bring you some little goodies from the forest.
You won. No love, love don't come easy. But I keep on waiting. I'm just waiting for that soft voice to talk to
you. All right, we are back. It's the Rebecca Giro Show. Thanks for sticking around. And we've got on the line trans issues correspondent for The Advocate, Parker Malloy. Hey, Parker, how you doing?
Hey there. I'm doing all right.
Good. So glad you were able to come on with us. You know, I really wanted to talk to you because you've been working for The Advocate a while, and you've been doing a lot of articles for them. And then all of a sudden, you wrote this article about Dallas Buyers Club and Jared Leto, and you said a couple of things that, well, you know, it ticked off people. I honestly did not see this coming. I read your article. I thought it was quite good. But did you expect the reaction that you got from people like Calpurnia Adams and Andrea James to what you wrote?
No. I mean, that, you know, I feel awful about the fact that in writing that piece, that particular op-ed, which was titled "What People Don't Get About Dismay of Jared Leto," the whole point of the piece was that there are so many different kinds of trans identities, yet on screen we tend to see only one. And that was the general idea behind it. It was supposed to be this big, happy, hey, you know, let's celebrate binary, non-binary, you know, all sorts of trans identities, you know, mixed in there. But then, you know, it ended up coming back to just the example that I tried to use, which I now feel terrible about, where I, you know, basically was trying to say, see, like, even for instance, Calpurnia just wrote this article the other day, you know, and, you know, she's different than I am, and that's cool. You know, diversity is great. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem she read it. It doesn't seem that she read it quite that way.
Well, you know, I have to say, and this is just from personal observation here, I don't think Calpurnia in particular likes anybody like us, whether it's trans media in general. I mean, she's never come out and attacked me personally, but I read the same article you did that she wrote in response, and the contempt for trans media people and activists was palpable in this thing. It seemed like she had attacked you. Not in almost, I mean, yeah, okay, she gave some reasons, but it seemed like more she was attacking you for being a trans media person than almost for actually what you said, and was like out to basically demean you. And frankly, all the people who do the kind of things that we do in terms of being trans women and trans people who create media for the community, it just seemed like her contempt for all of us really shined through. Do you think that was a motivator there?
You know, I honestly don't know what the motivating factor behind that piece was. I mean, in, you know, her Huffington Post piece, I assume you're referring to, right? That was originally on the blog.
Exactly.
Okay, great. I mean, I honestly, I don't quite know where that, you know, came from. It was brought to my attention that there was some language in my piece that she took issue with, and I felt terrible that I didn't write clear enough to, you know, get my point across. You know, instead it kind of ended up in these murky, you know, murky mm-hmm. waters.
Absolutely.
So you know, it was just one of these things where as soon as it was brought up to me, as soon as I found out that she was upset by some of the, you know, a couple of the words that were used, which I felt awful at, you know, the fact that, yeah. You know, I put something in there that wasn't, you know, I said something to the effect of, she's a showgirl, a,
I think you called her, didn't, correct me if I'm wrong here, but didn't you, I believe you said you called her a drag queen, and she took great offense to that.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. So in the piece, I said that, and, you know, when I was writing it, I was just trying to come up with a few different terms that I thought she, you know, honestly used to label herself. And, you know, in doing a quick search, you know, online, I mean, that popped up, and, you know, I feel terrible for using that. It wasn't meant in a, it wasn't meant in any sort of misgendering type of way. You know, it's,
it certainly didn't seem that way to me. And I read this with a experienced eye. I mean, I've been doing this a while, and I certainly didn't get that feeling from you. But another thing I wanted to ask you about, because this is something that Andrea James brought up, and I was curious. I know that you tweeted, and this has been reposted all over the net, and I'm going to read this tweet, because I think I want people to hear this before I ask you about it. What
sounds
you tweeted
really bad
was,
when you read it out loud, though.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, we're on radio, so, you know.
Yeah, I know,
I want to read what you wrote here. You wrote, yeah. I fucking hate RuPaul. Like, there are very few people I truly hate. He is one of them. Now, I want to ask you, looking back on that now, with a little bit of hindsight, I mean, you wrote this a few weeks ago. In hindsight, do you regret posting that?
Absolutely. I mean, I regretted posting that about 10 minutes after I wrote it. But it's just one of those things where it was a day that I was frustrated with, you know, if I remember correctly, that was the day after his show ran that awful female or shemale game or something like that. And earlier that day, I had been tweeting about how, you know, the various times where trans people have tried to work with that show to try to get them to, you know, ease up on the language that, you know, many people consider to be transphobic. You know, I mean, if you look back in 2012, Autumn Sandeen wrote a piece over at Fire Dog Lake about RuPaul using the word tranny. Right. And it goes back further, you know, 2010, you know, basically it's not like this just popped up. So it's one of these things where I was frustrated with the fact that he has been made aware that he uses these words that hurt people. And for better or for worse, he hasn't changed anything about how he conducts himself. And it's just this sort of, you know, questioning of, does he even, you know, where I pretty much ask myself, you know, does he really even care what we think? You know, which that's something I don't know. I don't know the answer to, you know, I don't think he has any intentionally, you know, he's not just out to try to hurt someone. But at the same time, you know, it's frustrating when, you know, people say, hey, here's this one word or here are these two words that really hurt. You know, an entire group of people, can you not use them? And they go, and then, you know, as he said in that 2012 Huffington Post interview, where he said that he loves the word tranny, and, you know, anyone who doesn't like it, you should say, fuck you, you effing tranny, or something like
right.
that, where it's just hurtful. Like, I remember reading that and just, like, my heart sank.
Yeah, I remember I heard that interview, and when Michelangelo Signorelli posted it on an article that he wrote at the Huffington Post, and I wrote a post for the Huffington Post about this that said, my title of my post was, "You don't get to tell us when to be offended, RuPaul." And I mean, you know, and so, yeah, I totally feel what you're saying there. I mean, this is not something to my mind. That we could say, when they came out and said we're newly sensitized, I practically was laughing, because I was like, you have got to be kidding. You have got to be kidding. I mean, this is not something that is new. I mean, people have been calling, and I you know, and we focused on this on the show last week, you know, GLAAD and other activist organizations that support trans people and trans rights and are, you know, looking out for things like this. None of them came out to say anything until, you know, folks started making an issue of it. But, yeah. I think it's interesting. And I want to point out that I did reach out to Andrea James to see if she would come on the show. She was not able to make it this week. I am hoping that she will come on and present her views next week. I did not bother to come out to Calpurnia. I did not bother to contact her because I don't believe – I think she just is so filled with contempt for us as trans media folks and as activists and as people who are not in her circles – that I felt it would be a waste of my time to do that. And I don't know. I have to ask you, you're relatively new to the sphere of trans media. I mean, I saw you started working for The Advocate about October of last year, right?
I think that's when the first piece I wrote for them, you know, went up, which was, it was just an op-ed, but it wasn't until December that I started writing for them regularly, which is on a freelance basis. So I'm not an employee of theirs, just freelance.
Right. And I will point out something that I know and that everybody who has ever done freelance work knows, which is nobody gets rich doing this. It's essentially contract work. You're not a staffer. And yet, I wonder, now that you've been doing this for a while, are there any lessons you've learned about this that you're going to carry forward as you continue?
Which is kind of the sad thing here is, It was right around the late part of March that I really started to reevaluate. I was like, okay, how am I using social media? How am I presenting myself, you know, publicly? And, you know, I realized, I was like, okay, I swear a lot on Twitter, I've gotten some people like sending me messages like, hey, I would keep following, but you say fuck like way too often. So, you know, it's like, okay, that's fair. That's the totally fair. I can cut back on that. I've kind of really started to think about how I'm going to do that. I've started to focus a little more on, working to get whatever I'm trying to say out to a larger audience, which means, using language that people can relate to, for example, anytime I write the word cisgender, which basically just means you're not trans. One of my pieces, I quickly define the word. So it's one of these things where it's like, hey, here, read this piece, and you can learn as you go.
It's funny because I have been avoiding using the word cisgender in my work because I have felt that I wanted my work to be as universally acceptable as possible. Uh-huh. And I thought that was kind of a word that wasn't universally understood yet. What I found is that editors, Valerico, the Huffington Post, have actually been putting that word into my articles, where I didn't include it, but they did. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing. Do you think it's becoming, like, words like that, like cisgender, genderqueer, and things like that, are they becoming the norm, do you think?
I think it would be great if they were. Slowly. I mean, we have to remember that, there was a time where, how people think about, words like cisgender, for example, was very similar to how people thought of words like heterosexual. No, I'm not heterosexual. I'm normal. No, I'm not cisgender. I'm normal. Those types of things where it's, basically taking a word and saying no, there's no normal, you know, there's gay, there's straight, there's, you know, heterosexual, homosexual, transgender, cisgender, you know, no one is more valid than anyone else because of this, you know. That's why I am a fan of the word cisgender, because it's not a slur, you know, referring to someone that is, you know, cis just means the opposite of trans, which is just on the same side of. So cisgender means you're, you know, obviously, like, means you're like 99% of the world.
Well, okay. So I don't know. I mean, I have to tell you, I've been, you know, obviously I've been following this issue. And, you know, I remember the old days when, and I have to include the Advocate in this, where, frankly, when I started writing, not only wasn't the Advocate looking to publish trans information or issues or hire somebody to do freelance work for them or an op-ed, even free op-eds, we actually had to call them out on a regular basis for saying stuff that, like, was, you know, almost as bad as what we're hearing from other places. And it seems like there's been a turn, like there's been a change. All of a sudden, you know, folks like you are getting work, folks like me are getting work. You know, there's an interest there now. Janet Mock's book went on the New York Times bestseller list. Yeah. I mean, you know, it seems like this is the moment. I will tell you, so speaking from the long view, a moment that we've been waiting for a very, very long time. Do you yeah. agree with that?
You know, it seems that seems like a fair assessment. I mean, it really does seem like, you know, for all the places that are still, you know, absolutely awful about trans coverage and, you know, promoting trans interest. The fact that we're starting to get some, you know, some heavy hitters behind us, you know, I mean, Janet Mock, you know, even though her Piers Morgan interview was kind of a mess, I mean, you know, no fault of hers. She was on CNN. That's really cool. You know, same thing with, you know, after Dr. V, Caleb Hannon debacle thing a few months back, Christina Carl was on CNN, and, you know, Janet Mock's been on MSNBC a number of times. Same thing with, you know, Cece McDonald's been on there. So it's great to see that we're starting to be, you know, we're taken seriously as human beings, you know, with thoughts and opinions and everything, you know, and not necessarily just as, you know, human science projects, which,
right.
You know, I always joke, you know, there's trans as, you know, trans as punchline, trans as, you know, just these different tropes that, you know, people use when, you know, utilizing trans people in their work. And one of them is certainly trans as science experiment or, you know, trans as biology lesson. And that's why I ended up getting the chemical symbol for estradiol tattooed on my arm. I was like, I am trans as science experiment.
Well, you know, I guess in some ways, I mean, we are the only members of the LGBT community that actually, you know, undergo medical procedures and take drugs to be who we are, or to, that's probably a bad way to phrase it, facilitate being who we are. Sure. Is maybe a better term. But at the same time, it seems to me that now, you know, folks like us, it's become, like you said, we're starting to be taken more seriously, but yet at the same time, I look at for example, the comments at my op-ed at The Advocate this morning, or just today, about 11:35 it posted. And for the first couple of hours, all I saw were negative comments, mainly from gay men, who are like, leave RuPaul alone, you people are ridiculous. And then all of a sudden, the trans women started popping in and challenging these guys. And it became like a real battle royale in the comments. And I'm wondering if that's where we are now, that this is the fight.
Well,
this is the fight we have to have today.
You know, and
do you think?
Here's the thing. I don't think, trans women versus gay men is, a good fight for anyone, but I think we need to be able to call out intra-LGBT transphobia and transmisogyny. And that's what things like this are. When someone screws up, if a friend of mine does something that hurts me, just because they're my friend doesn't mean I can't say, hey, that really hurt me when you did this. And I think that, I really wish that, people could take criticism without, calling you homophobic for it, or...
transphobic, it seemed like they were just throwing charges. And of course, I'm talking about Andrea James, Calpurnia Adams here. It seemed like they were just throwing charges around, like you were throwing mud on the wall and seeing what would stick. It didn't seem like they had any real basis for those arguments. So you know what? We got a few minutes left. I'm just going to ask you this because I mean, I think I know the answer already, but I'm just going to ask you, are you a separatist?
No. That was, of all the things that were said in all of those articles, which again, I want to make it absolutely clear that, I think I'm happy for Calpurnia and for Andrea and for every trans person out there. I'm happy that all of these different identities exist. And, if criticism takes the form of, an op-ed aimed at me, then, so be it. I'll survive. But no, I'm not a separatist. if anything, I'd like to think that I'm pretty inclusive. I mean, I'm a firm believer that, in the existence of non-binary people, which I know that, a somewhat old school belief is that non-binary people aren't really trans or something like that, but I feel that's ridiculous. Non-binary people are just as valid as I am, as you are,
I think non-binary people are whatever they say they are, quite
exactly.
frankly.
I think everyone is whatever they say they are.
That's really where I come down on it. You tell me what you are.
Bodily autonomy is key to, being able to accept trans people. We can't set up these weird hierarchies of, oh, well, you've had surgery. Oh, well, you're on hormones. I mean, if someone doesn't want surgery or can't afford it or doesn't want hormones or can't go on them, they're still just as valid as I am. Or
exactly.
if, whatever their journey is personally, that's awesome. I think a separatist is someone who says, no, you have to be, you have to be this tall to ride, level six true transsexuals only beyond this point, please.
Well, I would say you would argue that a separatist also is somebody that says I'm only going to associate with certain people who I approve of and who are just like me. Kind of the way Calpurnia Adams addressed you and spoke about trans folks. I also saw a comment on Facebook where they made a reference to you and I forget who it was, but suggesting some sort of an interaction and a conversation. She said, oh, I don't associate with those people. That sounds more like a separatist to me.
Her website has two different forums. One is for I don't know exactly how it pans out, but there are like two different forums you can join on her website. One is for, it's set up to like, oh, you're not transsexual, you can go in this one. Oh, you are, you can go in this one. And I think that division is just, seems strange. I mean, I'm all for, big tent, you know, drag queens are cool. You know, whether they identify as trans or not, I have nothing against drag queens. But, my issue is, you know, transphobic slurs. But drag queens are awesome. No, that's cool.
I love a drag show, personally.
That was slightly off topic. But, you know, basically, I just believe we need to, you know, accept all trans identities and, you know, and well, all human identities. There's no wrong way to be a human.
Which I
tweeted that the other day, which, you know, I mean, it's not as catchy as saying I hate someone, which I, to be clear, I do not hate RuPaul. he may frustrate me. The things he does may frustrate me, but I do not hate him. That's the key, beyond a poor choice of words.
Hate is a very different thing as those of exactly. us who, you know, many of us have come to learn. Parker, I want to say thank you so much for coming on, taking the time. I know this may not have been an entirely comfortable interview for you, but I really do appreciate you taking the time to do it.
You know, I'm glad that you know you had me on. Thank you for that. And I hope that I just hope that this cleared things up a little bit as far as you know what my personal views are. You know, I have no ill will towards. You know, anyone, Andrea, Calpurnia, anyone in the world, or RuPaul. Last weekend I watched But I'm a Cheerleader. He's in that. It's still one of my favorite movies ever.
Absolutely.
And,
Parker,
yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on. We're out of time, but I do hope you'll come on again, get in some issues with us, and maybe not some of this stuff. Maybe we'll talk some actual, you know, trans news and issues and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Not having to talk about myself? Yeah, totally.
Well, hopefully you won't be being attacked again. Although I will warn you, join the party. You've gotten your initiation and you can now collect your membership card in the Trans Media Club. So thank you so much for coming on and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now. All right, and that was Parker Marie Malloy, trans issues correspondent for The Advocate. We are going to go to a break. This is called from Anthony and the Johnsons. It's called Find the Rhythm of Your Love. We'll catch you in about five. All right, we are back. It's the Rebecca Giro Show. Thanks for sticking around. And wow, wasn't that a great interview? I love Parker. I think she's great. I think she's terrific. I know people have made comments. I mean, I made a few comments publicly about, I wasn't going to go here. But all right. I made a few comments about the Trans 100 a while back that I've gotten some emails about. Basically, my argument was, well, it seems to be rather youth-focused, not a lot of attention being paid to, well, folks my age. They've 100 slots. They chose Jillian Weiss, Dr. Jillian Weiss, awesome choice. Nancy Nangeroni, the legendary trans radio host, who frankly was somebody, it was the first place, the very first place when I came out that I was able to find any information about not so much being trans, because I'd already gathered a lot of that information, but about the community, about who are these people collectively. As a community, because at that point it was hard even to find the community. I mean, you had to locate it. I mean, it was there, but you had to seek it out. And so through Nancy and her show Gender Talk, I was able to start making those connections. And I was introduced to people and figures in the community who I had never heard, but who led me to different places and places to seek out information and make connections. And it was so important to my coming out process. And I will tell you that that's a major driver. It's one of the reasons why I do this show, because her show meant so much to me when I came out, that on top of, you know, I want to provide news and information and commentary and all that stuff for everybody who is the community. But I also, another driver for me is I want to be that host that the trans person tunes into for the first time when they're looking for help or for information or to understand. And I would like to be one of those people. I would like to do for the people who are following my generation what Nancy and others like her did for me. Because when I came out, Nancy was it. Okay, and one of the things that really bothered me about the Trans 100 was they had this young presenter on. I have no idea how old he was, but he was obviously a young person. And he completely mangled Nancy Nangiarone's name. Completely mangled it. All right, well, you know, people make mistakes, blah, blah, blah. But what was obvious was from the tone, from the way he read this thing, or her inclusion of the trans, he had no clue who she was, or the fact that she was this well-known legendary radio host, or the fact that she was a member of the original Transsexual Menace with Ricky Wilsons and several other trans people, mostly trans women, but trans people, who were the people who spoke out when Brandon Tina was murdered. And this is before my time. This is before I came out. You know, who did really significant historical things. And I felt like that was completely, completely removed from this. All they were interested in is what happened in the last year. And it bothers me. It bothers me a lot. I'm sorry, it does. I believe that there is a need for trans history. I believe it should be respected. I believe it should be honored. I believe that the people who helped make it should be recognized. And I felt that wasn't done. I felt that everybody was young. They were talking within and among themselves. And nobody looked outside their own bubble to see, well, you know, who besides ourselves should we be talking about here? I mean, honestly, I was disappointed. I'm not saying that young people should not be honored. I think they should. I think there are some people doing some great work. Parker was on the list this year, and it's absolutely deserving. But you know what? So are a lot of other people. A lot of other significant people who have been snubbed twice now. And you know what? It's noticed. People notice this stuff. And I'm not just saying it because I'm one of those people. Okay, it would be nice. But that's not really the motivation here. I mean, I just thought that there are so many. And I'm not going to list names, okay? But I will tell you there are a lot of them. And I think it should be more balanced. I think if you're going to hold an event that reflects the whole community, then it should reflect the whole community. And I'm not saying it necessarily has to be 50-50. I'm not saying that there should be quotas. I'm not saying any of that stuff. But I do think it should be substantially more balanced. And frankly, better run. I'm sorry. I think that the folks who are running this thing need help. They need help from people who are professional and experienced and skilled in doing this kind of thing. And I think it showed. I think the folks who put this together really don't know what they're doing or didn't know what they're doing. And I think it showed in every aspect of what it did. And I'm not trying to bash, and this is not in any way, I want to be clear, not in any way a reflection on the people who were chosen. I think they're all awesome. That is not the issue here in any way. That is not the issue. The issue is how this event is being run and presented and the criteria that is being used to choose those who are being honored. I think it needs to be a little bit more reflective. I think trans history and trans and people who are figures in trans history should be honored and respected just as the younger folks are. I think there needs to be some more balance there. And that was the one thing that stuck out to me more than anything else, was the lack of balance. It was so skewed towards the under 40 crowd that how could someone of my age, I might as well tell you, this is no secret. I mean, next month, in about a month, on May 8th, I'll turn 52. You know, I've got a different perspective than Parker or any of the other young folks. And that's not to discount that perspective or any perspective. It's simply to say this perspective, my contemporary's perspective, that matters also. We are a part of this community also. We deserve recognition also. That's what I'm saying. I mean, I think if you're going to have any kind of event about the trans community, it should be inclusive of the entire community. And I think one of the things that maybe some of the folks who are doing this, who are running this thing, who are the younger folks in particular, and maybe some of the older folks, I don't know, I'm not going to assign motivations here because I don't know. I can't say, but I think maybe they need to look a little further, and they need to be able to think, and they need to be able to understand that those of us who fought tooth and nail for decades for inclusion in publications like The Advocate, for inclusion in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, for inclusion in the greater LGBT community, for inclusion at those pride centers, for inclusion. We have been fighting this battle for inclusion. It is a key, central part of what we have been doing in this community in terms of activism, in terms of media, literally for decades. And I think that the way this is run, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it. I think it spits on that effort. I think this effort felt like disinclusion. Like only the special people are going to get noticed here. The rest of you, well, too bad. Sorry, we're not thinking about you anymore. That's what it felt like. Now, is that the real motivation? Probably not. I'm not going to go and assign motives to people. I'm just not going to do it. But that's what it felt like. It's what it felt like. It felt like, well, the only people we care about are the people who are just like us. That's what it felt like. And I'm talking feelings here. Again, not assigning motivations, not assigning agendas, and who knows, there may be some. I can't say to that. I can't speak to that. But that's what it felt like to me. And I'm sorry. I have trouble being enthusiastic about an event that doesn't practice the inclusion that we have been preaching for decades. It seems hypocritical to me that be what you want. If you demand inclusion, you have to practice inclusion. And I don't think that was practiced here. I think that that was directly opposed to that ideal. And that bothers me. It bothers me a lot. Because it seems like we're forgetting our history. We're forgetting where we came from. We're forgetting how we got here. We're forgetting why it's possible for a Parker Marie Malloy to work at The Advocate. We're forgetting why it's possible for someone like me to have an op-ed on their front page today. We're forgetting how we got here. And if you want to know where you're going, you got to know where you've been. And I wish, I hope, I pray, although I'm not a religious person, what I would like to see is, and I'm not going after anybody individually here, but I would like to see this event taken over by folks who are going to do it right, who are going to make this a celebration of the entire community, who are not just going to make it yet another party for the young and pretty, which is what it sure as hell felt like to me as I watched that stream. I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't have felt this way 10 years ago, but I do now. I do now. And, you know, I know that other people may feel I'm selfish, I'm self-centered about this or whatever. And you know what? Fine. If you want to believe that, so be it. But I can't help feeling that. I'm telling you what I feel. I think that there's a real lack of interest and a bad, terrible lack of interest in where we've come from, in the history and the history makers of our community. And I think that's detrimental. I think it hurts. I think, and you know something else? You know something else? It's also one of the reasons why I started writing my book. Because if I don't tell my story, if Janet Mock doesn't tell her story, although, frankly, Janet Mock is considerably younger than I am, so her story doesn't start where mine does, but frankly, it's a very, very, very different story. Those of you who read her book know it was a great story, an engaging story, a wonderful story. It's easy to see why it went to the New York Times bestseller list. But it's not my story at all in any way. My story is very, very different. As my story is very, very different from Jennifer Finney Boylan, who's a little bit older than I am and comes from an era that's slightly removed, slightly behind. She's closer, I would venture to say, and I don't know how old she is, but I would venture to say that Jenny Boylan is probably closer in age to Nancy Nangeroni and Ricky Wilshins and that generation than to myself. But I think if you're going to have an event to honor the community, do it in a way that honors everyone. Don't turn it into another HRC gala. Don't turn it into another glad celebrity party. Come on. Turn this into something that everybody can feel good about. I wish, you know, some of the folks that are running this, I would like to see, and I don't know if they should be replaced. I'm not in a position to make those kind of assessments. But I would like to see people step up and help and help this evolve into something that's what it should be, that what it deserves to be, something that makes all of us feel good, something that celebrates the entirety of our community, something that remembers, that shows the people who watch it that we know, remember, and honor our history. And I really feel strongly about that. But in order to have trans history, somebody has to write that history. And so that's a big reason why I started writing my book. Because I want to be a part of that, I've decided. I want to help write that history. And, you know, who knows how well this will do. Maybe I'll join Janet Mock on the New York Times bestseller list. Maybe it'll be in the discount rack in the back of a, you know, community bookstore. I have no idea. But I know I got to try. I know that I won't feel right about it and fully at peace with it until I can say, I've done my part. I told my story. I put it out there for everyone to see and read and experience and to incorporate into the ever-evolving history that is this community. And I feel like I am in a position to do that. I think it's a good one. It's worth reading. If I didn't, I wouldn't be bothering to do this. You know, and I think as I said earlier, I think I'm a pretty decent writer, so I think I can pull this off. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take a long time. I mean, Janet Mock, I forget where she mentioned it, but I remember her mentioning at some point that it took her 3 years to write her book. I'll tell you what, I can understand why. This is hard. It's really, really hard. And that's probably why most people don't do it. I mean, if it was easy, everybody could do it. You know, there's a reason why even today there's still only a handful of us out there making media. Because if everybody could do this stuff, we'd have lots of this. But everybody can't. Some of us have to learn, and some of us have to teach. And I'm going from, you know, I was a learner. Now I'd like to think maybe I'm a teacher now, or at least a teacher's aide or something. So I would like to, I find myself fond of putting myself into that position if the community will accept me in it. I hope others will also step up and do the same. That there are so many of these stories that need to be told, and so much history that people need to learn. That, you know, and again, like I said, I can experience as well as anybody how hard it is to write these stories and to put them out there for public consumption. But if we don't, who will? We're the only ones who can. There are stories. There are stories. It's our history. And I believe that as a community, as a trans community, we need to honor and respect it, because the battles of the past are the foundation of the battles of the present and the battles of the future. We were fighting for inclusion then. We're fighting for inclusion now, today, every day, in all kinds of things, all kinds of things. For example, as a matter of fact, I was digging around for some news today, I found an article. This comes to us from New York Daily News. A Christian university in Oregon. Now, I'll tell you about that because we're about to go to break. I'll come back with some news after our break. But we see the examples of where we need to fight for inclusion even today. And I'm going to give you a good one after we come back from this break, and we have got Israeli trance artist. This is a new one on me. Ayure with DOA with Doa. Oh, I Jesus, this is hard. Adjure with Doa.
I think I would say Adore and Doa.
Ah, okay. The lovely tones of Mr. Mike Scott coming to help out the poor, befuddled host.
But then I don't really know. I'm just guessing, just like you are.
Okay. Well, you know, it's Israeli. My best friend Robin's coming in this week. She speaks like fluent Hebrew. I should ask her. She'll know.
It's so, a lovely song.
Next time we have to play this artist, I'll at least know the correct pronunciation, if nothing else. All right, gang, we'll catch you in 5.
The voice of spring. I bring you some little goodies from the forest.
You won.
The broadcast was spreading.
Rebecca Giro show, and wow, great show tonight. Talking to Parker Malloy, she was great. And then I got into a little something just a little earlier about the Trans 100, but I was starting to talk about inclusion, which is something we've been fighting for in this community, whether it's ENDA, whether it's the media, whether it's just personal spaces, whatever. This has been a battle that the trans community has been fighting for a lot of years. And it seems to me that the Trans 100 should be modeling that value of inclusion, of doing everything possible to make everybody feel a part of it and not just, you know, a token when everybody else is in this other group, and then just like kind of throw in a few tokens from the other group to make faux inclusion, which is what I think, frankly, happened at the Trans 100. I think they probably realized at the end, oh my God, we've got no people over 50. We better throw a few in. And that's exactly what they did. They threw a few in. I mean, I don't know that. I don't know that. But that's what it seemed like to me. And along those lines of inclusion, I want to read this story that I found this on New York Daily News website today. I want to talk about this. This is about a Christian university in Oregon that bans a transgender student, a trans man, from an all-male dorm. Jace, who is a transgender sophomore at George Fox University, he doesn't know where he's going to live next year because apparently the school banned him from living in an all-male dorm. Jace says all of the alternatives that the school provided make him feel rejected, misunderstood, and punished for something he cannot change. Jace is, again, transgender sophomore. He transitioned from female to male socially. They say socially. I am not sure. I guess that means he's not on hormones yet, I presume. I'm not quite sure because, you know, every time you see one of these things in straight media, you know that the person writing it probably doesn't really get the whole transgender thing. So you have to read straight media articles about transgender people very carefully in that way. But apparently, Jace lodged a sex discrimination complaint against Oregon's George Fox University this past Friday. He said, and he told this to a local station, KGW, he said, I am a man. I deserve to be treated like any other man on campus. Jace's friends and family, they already recognize him as male. He is in the process of legally changing his gender on his driver's license and Social Security. And in December, he alerted administrators at this school his wish to live with his male friends, but the university denied the request. And what they said was they released a statement that says, George Fox strives to be a Christ-centered community, and our residential facilities are single-gender because of our theological commitments. The students' request to switch from female-only to on-campus housing to male-only on-campus housing is one that many institutions would struggle with, which kind of says nothing. All they're doing is trying to avoid very hard slurring him directly, which, all right, at least you'll give them a dollop of credit for that, but not that that means much, but at least they didn't openly call him a freak, which is nice. Apparently, this school was founded by Quakers 115 years ago, and it's worth pointing out that Quaker theology emphasizes social justice and diversity. But, of course, apparently that doesn't apply if you're transgender, because, you know...
Can I point something out? Richard Nixon was a Quaker.
He absolutely was.
Yes.
Of course, not that he necessarily put those values into practice in his presidency. Social justice? Well, I don't know. Diversity? Oh, for sure not. You read some of the transcripts of those recordings, the Watergate recordings, it's like he is virulently racist and all kinds of things. But in any case, let me continue with this. Apparently, the school is reportedly adopting a new policy that ensures housing decisions are made solely on biological birth sex. Yeah, lovely, isn't it? Apparently, the university gave Jace two options for the coming school year. He could either live in an off-campus apartment with male roommates as long as he legally changed his gender and informed his roommates' parents about his gender change. Like, it's any of their fucking business, right? The other option was to live in a single room on campus with the university promising to make sure he was still connected to the larger student body. But apparently Jace was not happy with either of those options. And he said, and this is Jace speaking, "While I appreciate university administrators meeting with me regarding my housing requests, their ultimate decision makes me feel rejected, misunderstood, and punished for something I cannot change. It also makes me anxious and nervous about where I'll be able to live next year and the year after that, especially if their housing policy based on biological birth sex goes into effect." Now, Jace's lawyer says that the first option would have violated Jace's right to privacy, and the second seems like an outright violation of Jace's rights. Now, don't forget, we're talking about a school in Oregon here, which has good civil rights. I don't know exactly what they have, but I do believe they have trans rights. I know they do in Portland and some of the other major cities. I am not exactly sure off the top of my head what the status is, but I do believe that a lot of Oregon, if not all of it, has rights. But of course, there are always these religious exemptions, you know. Apparently, Jace's lawyer filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education under Title IX, which prohibits discrimination based on sex and gender. Jace's mom has been supportive and started a change.org petition on his behalf. The mom wrote, "Jace's friends on campus have no problem living with him. They support and respect him. I am hoping the university will show the same care and respect as Jace's friends have and allow Jace to live with them for the sake of his mental health and well-being." George Fox retaliated, the university retaliated by claiming that the lawyer's account doesn't give a complete picture of this complex situation. Oh, I think it does. I think it's pretty, I don't think it's a complex situation. You either support inclusion or you do not. And that is what this is about. It's about inclusion. It's exactly what it is about. Whether it is about inclusion as a trans man into the male community of this university, or if it's about inclusion in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or if it's about inclusion in being able to use the bathroom that corresponds with your presented gender, or about inclusion, whether you can go to get a drink in a bar or a meal in a restaurant without having somebody coming up to you and saying, sorry, we don't serve you here because the law doesn't require us to, as is the case in 33 states. Now, of course, not every bar, not every restaurant, not every place you go to is going to give you a hard time. In fact, most probably won't. As long as your money's as green as anyone else's, most companies are smart enough to know they're not going to do that. It's just going to bring them problems. And they don't need that. That hurts business. But that's not everyone. There are plenty of people who will. And now we have legislators in states like Arizona and Mississippi that are trying to pass laws, and in fact successfully did pass a law, was just signed into law by Governor Phil Bryan in Mississippi, that are enshrining that, and not that they needed to, but passing laws that basically, they're not really providing new protections for people who feel religiously or whatever. They are, it's like what they're doing is they're making a legal roadmap to say, here's how you go after the queers. Seriously, that's what this is about, because there is no thing that these laws do that they're passing that changes anything about the legal situation in Arizona or in Mississippi, except in the specific cases where a municipality or a county or some other below state level government has enacted those rights. So in a state like Mississippi, which has virtually nothing like that, it changes nothing. This is just a way of saying, come on, join us in hating the queers. Let's run them out of town. Grab your pitchforks. Grab your torches. We're going to string them up. That's what they're doing. That's what this is doing. This is legislative. What's the word I'm looking for? Lynching. Yes, I'm going to use it. I'm going to use the word. This is legislative lynching. That's what this is. Legislative lynching. And I know that's a loaded word, and it carries a lot of history with it. And I appreciate that, and I understand that. And this has nothing to do with that historical definition, except in the sense that it is people who are bigoted, taking that bigotry, organizing, and using it to destroy people's lives. That's what is going on. And in that sense, it is exactly the historical definition of bigotry. Okay, maybe you're not finding these folks at the end of a noose. But legally, you're going out of your way to destroy these people's lives, to encourage people to discriminate, to present their hate publicly. That's what this is about. And thank goodness, Jan Brewer, right winger that she is, at least was smart enough to say, you know what? This is not where the country is today. This is going to hurt us as a state. Mississippi, they don't give a shit. What do they care? Okay. I mean, you think Mississippi has the kind of tourist business that Arizona does? I bet not. Okay. I mean, what do they have there? Really? I mean, seriously. Okay. I can tell you. Okay. Louisiana, you got New Orleans, you got Florida, you got all kinds of resorts and places. Alabama, well, you've got some major historical sites. You got Selma, you got all these places. What do you have? What the hell is in Mississippi? Why would people want to go there if you didn't live there already? It's one of the poorest states in the nation. It's also the most bigoted state in the nation. Why would you want to go there unless you had to? Why would you want to do anything but drive through or fly over as quickly as humanly possible? So they don't give a shit. They're not looking. They're not worried about gay tourism. Like with the way George Takei wrote, they said, you know, we're going to take our tourist dollars elsewhere and we're going to tell our friends to do the same. That's a real threat in Arizona. Mississippi, who cares? they're probably celebrating. You know, they would much rather, you know, if they find it, if they find any of them queers in there, they're going to burn down their house. That's what they're going to do, because Jesus told us to. That's right. That's right. Listen to my brother Fred Phelps. He knows what's going on. That's right. No, I mean, seriously. I mean, I'm being okay. I'm being a little, I'm being a little okay. And I don't want anybody to think, but you know, I'm mocking old Southern white guys. That's what that voice was supposed to be. I don't know if it actually sounded like that. But you see, that's the thing. This is, it's all about inclusion. All of it. It's all about inclusion. That's what these guys are saying, is we don't want to include you. We don't want you to be equal to us. That's what these laws are all about. And you know what? I'm going to take it back there one more time. That's why it stings when I see the kind of presentation at the Trans 100 that I did. Because it seems like these folks have forgotten what we're fighting for. And that, to me, is the scariest and most depressing thing of all. It really is. You have to learn from our past to advocate for our future. You have to. I don't know. You know, maybe it's all of a sudden, you know, I got a birthday coming up and I'm suddenly like, you know, my father passed late last year. Maybe I'm feeling a greater sense of my own mortality here and, you know, getting on years. But I can't help it. I this is so important. And it is such a key part of who we are as a community. And our goals and what we're striving for. And I don't want that to be lost. Not only don't I want it to be lost, I want it to be a key part and a goal in everything we do. Because that's what it's about. It's about opening doors. It's about walking through them. And then it's about opening the next door and walking through that. That's what it's about. And you can't do that if only certain people are allowed to walk through the door and others are left behind. That's where my feelings on the Trans 100 come from. So I want people to understand this because, again, I got some emails about this. I've had a few conversations here and there with people. And I originally I was just going to say, fuck it, I'm not going to cover this thing at all. That's kind of the way I felt like a week ago. But I decided, you know, and to be honest with you, I decided this just before I started talking about it. I decided we have to talk about this. We have to discuss it. We have to make this a part of the conversation that's going on in our community now, today, before we lose our history. Because our history is ours. We own it. We need to understand it. We need to respect it. We need to honor it. And we need to keep it for those who will follow us. Because they will need to know too. All right. Okay. I've gone off on a rant here, I know. Well, let's cover another story. Let's see here. This is interesting. There's apparently six regional and national organizations have filed arguments in federal court on behalf of a transgender retired police sergeant who brought a discrimination case against Howard County. Now, this is coming to us from the Baltimore Sun, so I assume this is in Maryland. Good old liberal Maryland, who just passed the law 5 minutes ago, but now you get to see why they needed this law. Apparently, the ACLU, Maryland chapter, and four other organizations have asked the U.S. District Court for permission to file a friend of the court brief to support this sergeant, Tommy B. Finkel. Tommy as in T-O-M-I. Now, I'm assuming that means that this is a male to female. It does refer to her as she, so I'll hopefully I'm correct in continuing to refer to her as she. Apparently, Finkel, 59, retired sergeant with the U.S. Capitol Police, claims in a suit filed in the fall that she was denied a position in the volunteer unit. In other words, this was a volunteer position because she's a transgender person. She said, I really appreciate them taking an interest in my case and in my behalf. She also added that neither she nor her lawyer sought that support. And she said, I know over the years they've helped a lot of people, which they certainly have. In the motion that they filed last week, the groups, including the Free State Legal Project, Lambda Legal, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the Transgender Law Center, argue against the county's motion to dismiss the suit. They argue case law supports Finkel's claim of discrimination under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the analogous Maryland law, and she does not have to prove the county knew her transgender status, as county lawyers have argued. The county lawyers have declined comment on this case. Well, yeah, big surprise there. Ilona Turner, legal director of the Transgender Law Center, which is, of course, as you guys know, national organization, which is based in Northern California. She said her group initiated the motion in part because of the potential significance of the case. She said there are not many cases involving transgender plaintiffs. Each one has, that reached the courts. So each one has the potential to set important precedent. So we look at each one with great interest. She also said that these briefs can help build a case by providing expertise that the parties to the case may not have. In her experience, she said it's rare for a judge to deny a motion to file such a supporting brief. No hearing date so far has been set. So well, what do you know? Gee, what's this about? Inclusion. Yeah, in a volunteer police force. Inclusion, inclusion, inclusion. Once again, inclusion. Anybody noticing a pattern here? Okay, now this is scary. This one is scary. This comes from Frontiers LA. I think this happened, believe it or not, in Connecticut, which frankly surprises me because I thought Connecticut was a little bit more liberal than this, but apparently not. Startling move. A transgender 16-year-old has been transferred to an adult prison in Connecticut, despite the fact that there are currently no criminal charges against this person. Apparently they're being very careful with the gendering here, which is fine. I'd rather they be careful than wrong. The unnamed teenager is under the care of the Connecticut Department of Children and Families, who have held her. I'll go ahead and assume that we're talking about a male to female here, I hope. Held her at various juvenile facilities for some time now in the wake of assaults against staff members at these facilities. DCF argued before a judge that it could not care for her at any of its facilities, so she was transferred to an adult prison on April 8th. Even worse, while she is currently being held at a women's facility, there is apparently a chance that she could be transferred to a male facility after an evaluation. Astonishingly, DCF Commissioner Joette Katz used the girl as an example while lobbying for a secure treatment facility for girls in Middletown, citing an incident in which a staff member was temporarily blinded and had their jaw broken to justify the measure. The facility was approved and is now open, but the girl used to justify its existence has been transferred out of DCF's care and not into the new facility. Internet activism group Anonymous caught the story, and they're putting pressure on Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy with various anonymous Twitter accounts encouraging people to contact the governor's office and reverse the decision. And if you want to help with that, it is at GOVMALLOY office. Hashtag Rethink Malloy. So if you want to participate in that, go for it. I'll read it one more time. At GOVMALLOYOFFICE. Hashtag Rethink Malloy. He can stop. Now, Governor Malloy, he can put a stop to this. And I'm frankly amazed because I thought Governor Malloy is a pretty progressive guy. You know, he supported the transgender rights law in the state, was a very staunch. So, you know, Governor Malloy can do something about this. He can do something about this. He can stop this from happening. I hope he will. I hope he will. And I hope you guys will help him do it. And what's it about, boys and girls and everyone else? Inclusion. Yeah. Will she be included with women as is appropriate? Or will she be excluded and forced to live with men? Again, again, again. It's all about inclusion. And I know I'm sounding like a broken record here, but I think this is so basic to who we are as a community that I expected better. I really did. And now we've only got, what have we got, 5 minutes left? Yeah. So we got one more to go here. Mr. Mike, my understanding is that you have a clip. We have a Texas teacher who was suspended after a parent complained about her transgender status. Mr. Mike, can you run that clip?
I think it's awful. My heart goes out to this woman, and I'm really sad that things like that still go on.
Not everyone feels that way about the transgender substitute teacher who's been suspended from Lumberton ISD.
There's some things that we can accept in society that children are not going to accept the same way that we do.
Some parents were outraged when they discovered Laura Jane Klug, born Kurt Klug, was substituting their children's fifth grade class at Lumberton Intermediate.
It's a very big distraction.
Roger Beard's son was in that class. Beard says he doesn't have a problem with transgendered people, but he does think that it causes a disruption in the classroom.
I really don't want them teaching, especially this age group. You know, they can do many things in life, but if it affects the young people that are little children and their ability to learn and grow naturally, I think there's an issue with that.
Klug says that she substituted at the school without any issues before, and she's unsure what instigated the outrage, saying, quote, "I've always conducted myself in a professional manner and would never discuss my gender identity at school." Klug says the Lumberton ISD school board will privately make the decision whether to allow her to continue substituting. She says right now she isn't sure what they will decide.
Becky, think of the children now.
Oh, my God. Now we should point out to people, right now, this is Texas. So needless to say, in fact, this is one of Parker's articles I'm reading from here. It was the clip you just heard was actually posted with her article. Again, here we go. Here we go. It's another issue with inclusion. Now, Texas, of course, as you may know, has no law whatsoever for trans or gay people, for any kind of anti-discrimination protections. And so it's up to this school to determine this teacher, who, as far as I can tell from the article and from this clip, certainly was a competent teacher, didn't cause any problems. There was no problem with her skills or her ability or anything else. But yet, here we go. Well, I don't want it to be around children. I don't want this person, I don't include her as a normal person who should be allowed to be a teacher because she's transgender. Inclusion, 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 inclusion. Here we go again. Okay? I mean, you heard what it is. I mean, she has said, and as far as I know, I have not yet seen this contradicted anywhere. Laura Jane Klug, she said, I've always conducted myself in a professional manner, would never discuss my gender identity in school. Nor should she. It's not an appropriate topic. She's not there to teach gender identity. She's there to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. And that's what she should do. And she should be able to do that, or be a cop, or be an airline pilot, or cashier at a store, or a college professor, or whatever. As long as she's good at doing those things, shouldn't be an issue. But yet, what happens is because in states like this, it's the same old song. I don't like it. So I don't think you should have the same rights that I do, because I don't like it. Well, you know what? I don't like pistachio ice cream. Doesn't mean I get to go to the supermarket and tell them to take it off the shelves. I'm sorry. My goodness. Once again, it's inclusion. All right, that is it. We are done. Again, we're done. Now, I want to remind everybody, because I forgot last week, 3 minutes. If you missed anything, if you missed Parker's great interview, if you missed anything, 3 minutes from now, we will be repeating the entire show. You can listen with me and Mr. Mike while we listen back. We will be back next week. I want to say thank you to Parker Malloy for coming on, talking to us. I want to say thank you to the ever amazing Mr. Mike Scott for twisting my knob so I can twist yours. And I want to say thank you to you for supporting this media, for tuning in every week, for supporting this show. We love you for it, and we'll catch you next week. Have a good night, everybody.
We're talking about some real sick stuff here. Man on man, hairy baby, BDSM, bottoms acting like tops, tops acting like bottoms. It's just the whole world gone topsy-turvy. You want it?